Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis, here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, October 12, 2017. I'm asking you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's get started with the news. Cascadia Forest Defenders is asking for support as they defend an Oregon forest from logging in this story from the Cascadia Forest Defenders, as found on the Earth First Newswire. The fabulously clear, cold waters of the McKenzie River watershed, home to several endangered salmon and trout runs and the drinking water for Eugene, will be affected by the proposed logging of 2,500 acres of Willamette National Forest in Oregon. We're fighting a sale called the Goose Project, which has been in the works for 8 years. Environmental lawsuits have bought us time, and Cascadia Forest Defenders continues to wield a diversity of tactics, legal and direct action. The campaign has been active in the woods since May, and we will continue to do everything we can to save this beautiful ecosystem. In this last May, Cascadia Forest Defenders put up two platforms 110 feet up in Douglas fir trees, named Libre and The Witness, on the site of a proposed helicopter logging pad. We've been tying in trees up in the canopy to prevent logging, since felling them would harm loggers, sitters, and other trees. We are gathering data on the ground about springs, preparing to escalate, and pursuing potential legal delays relating to sensitive endangered species that would be affected. We've had over 60 visitors out to the forest and trained over a dozen of them on how to climb safely. The sales are already sold to Seneca Sawmill, and contractors have been resurfacing the old logging roads in the area to prepare for logging beginning as soon as November. The Forest Service claims this sale, which would aggressively log 2,452 acres total and includes a good amount of dug fir forest older than 80 years, will enhance forest health but makes a poor case and contradicts recommendations for conserving by the Northwest Forest Plan and government documents. The Forest Service claims that logging will help this forest develop into old growth, but in moist areas, mature forests need time to develop into old growth, not logging. The Forest Service also fails to adequately address the effects of this timber sale on endangered species, water quality, carbon emissions, economics, and social factors. This is neither the largest nor the most egregious timber sale going on, not even in the local region, but it is emblematic of business as usual. We chose this sale because it has already been through a lawsuit and is easily accessed by public transportation. We've hosted a public hike, held two benefit shows, tabled weekly at the market, picked mushrooms, done 4 radio shows, 1 print interview, found a cast iron pan and a metal wood stove, and other useful miscellanea at our local dump, dumpstered food, and climbed trees. We've seen a cougar and several owls and heard spotted owl calls in the night, and seen all kinds of other forest critters like salamanders, voles, chipmunks, and deer, of course. We need more people who are willing to stay out in the forest as the weather turns and our tactics escalate. Tactical advice from experienced activists would also be appreciated. We need some pieces of gear, tarps, wall tents, cold weather sleeping bags. Of course, money helps, and so does media coverage. As of today, we've had a continuous woods presence for 135 days. Deforestation is a climate issue, a water issue, a biodiversity issue, an ecosystem integrity issue, an issue of human and planetary survival. We cannot afford to cut any more intact forest ecosystems anywhere, and in Cascadia it is a constant battle. Forest defense is a hell of a fun way to stick it to the man and build relationships with the earth and each other. To contact Forest Defender, Cascadia Forest Defenders, go to forestdefensenow.wordpress.com. That's forestdefensenow.wordpress.com. And mass action in Poland's Białowieża Forest. 3 blockades have happened at the same time in this story from Save Białowieża, as found on the Earth First Newswire. For the first time ever, 3 blockades of heavy equipment took place in the forest simultaneously. Last Friday, the Minister of Environment undermined the credibility of materials documenting the logging in the forest that were sent to the European Court of Justice. it can be assumed that the resort denies the fact of intense commercial logging. They also claim that the only works carried out at present aim at public safety, while not so long ago it was the spruce bark beetle that served as an excuse. In answer, activists are blocking heavy machines to show evidences and places where logging is taking place. On the 4th and 5th of October, activists from the camp and for the forest block logging and transport of timber in three places. The Wilski Tract, a forest road near the village of Termiski, where huge piles of logs are stored, near the educational center of Grudki, and at the parking space near the village of Powatski. At the parking lot at Powatski, after 2 hours of protest, the blockade was broken in a violent way. Men operating the machines started the engines and put the long arm of harvesters with protesters attached to it into motion. One of the workers took active parts in pacification of the blockade, tearing one of the activists and pulling him away, even though he had no right to do that. One of the forest guards used a knife to cut the tapes by means of which the protesters had their hands tied together inside the tubes they put on to create a human chain. Some of the activists got slightly hurt as a result. What is more, some women were pulled out of the tubes by force and by two forest guards at the same time. The second blockade in Grudki came to an end after 4 hours after an agreement between the machine operators was reached. Once the activists left, the workers took the machines back to the parking lot where they were to remain until evening. The third blockade in Wiski Tribe near Termiski is not over after 34 hours. The blockade is closing the forest route from both sides for harvesters and trucks, for huge stores of wood that are waiting for sale and transport. Barrels with concrete were placed there, and a platform hung on ropes among the trees to make it impossible for logging and transporting machines to enter. And an eco-warrior is taking a chainsaw to Indonesia's illegal palm plantations in this story written by Laura Villadiego of The Guardian and found on the Earth First Newswire. Armed with a chainsaw and a copy of Indonesia's environmental laws, biologist Rudy Putra and his team of eco-warriors have been identifying and cutting down illegal palm oil plantations and recovering the lost forests of the Lauser ecosystem. For decades, the exuberance of the large rainforest in Indonesia's North Sumatra region has succumbed to the rapid expansion of illegal palm oil plantations, threatening the habitats and endangering the lives of orangutans, rhinos, tigers, and elephants. Putra is trying to reverse the trend and since 2007 has been identifying plantations encroaching into the Gunung Lauser National Park, an area marked out by the Indonesian government as a conservation forest, protected by law from land conversion as listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The work is dangerous, but we have a strategy, says Putra. His team first identifies the owner of the illegal plantation and asks them to return the land to the authorities. We inform them your plantation is illegal and the police can arrest you. Most of them then release the land to avoid legal consequences, he said. Once the land is secured, the team have to cut down each tree with a chainsaw. It is an arduous and slow process. Once the plantation has been cut down, Putra's team lets nature take its course. We have evidence that in 5 years, forests can start recovering, he says. During this time, they monitor the area to protect young plants from many dangers, including elephants and other encroachments. So far, they have restored 2,000 hectares, roughly 5,000 acres, of the Aceh Tamiang district in the province of Aceh, according to Putra, and have started the reforestation of another 2,000 more hectares. In Indonesia, the world's largest palm oil producer, plantations are an old enemy of the rainforest. At least 56% of the palm oil plantations established in the country between 1990 and 2005 were opened at the expense of tropical forest, according to research by the ETH in Zurich. The Gunung Lauser National Park itself was put on UNESCO's danger list in 2011 due to the threats posed by poaching, illegal logging, agricultural encroachment, and plans to build roads through the site. Government actions also threaten the area. The Aceh government's new spatial plan, a set of land laws governing development, includes further concessions in the region. Citizens in the province initiated a class action lawsuit last year challenging the legality of the government's plans. Activists point to the palm oil sector as a main culprit in the degradation of the protected areas. The Rainforest Action Network has released a series of reports, the most recently in July of this year, accusing palm oil companies of having links to deforestation in the Loser ecosystem. Oil palms cover almost 11 million hectares in Indonesia, while new plantations have been increasing at a rate of between 300 and 500,000 hectares per year for the past 10 years. Putra, who was awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize in 2014, first picked up his chainsaw after his hometown in the district of Aceh Tamang was razed by the floods of 2006. The World Bank reportedly linked the floods to the deforestation of the area and estimated the total losses to be $210 million. Biologist is not the only one working to recover lush Sumatran rainforest. The Orangutan Information Center, an NGO working on the preservation of the habitat of these big mammals, has also claimed and restored 1,500 acres inside the Gunung Luser National Park, while the Aceh government and parks officials in the Gunung Luser have also claimed illegal plantations and recovered them. The forest is a life support system, and to protect the forest means to protect the future of any form of life, including human population, says Panut Haidasawoyo, founder of the Orangutan Information Center. Once the land is cleared from oil palms, the reforestation starts. We make a seedling nursery, find the most suitable seeds, and plant them. When seeds are germinated, we replant them in the ground, says Rio Ardi, restoration coordinator of the OIC. The replanting is difficult work. The new sprouts can easily be burnt by the intense sunlight or be destroyed by elephants or other animals, says Ardi. However, the success of the reforestation will ultimately depend on how we secure the land from encroachment and wildfires. Reestablishment of the forest to its original levels typically requires between 20 and 200 years, according to research published in Nature. However, according to the study, recovery in ages is slower than in other regions such as Central America and Africa. Despite these efforts, threats remain, says Butcher, in a world where the demand for palm oil increases every year. Indonesia aims to raise production to 40 million tons by 2020, up from almost 35 million tons last year. People have to understand, when they eat more from the palm oil product, that means we will be cutting down even more of the remaining forests, said Putra. And in the United Kingdom, hunt saboteurs save a fox from drunken hunters at a Ross Harriers meet. In this story from Bristol Hunt Saboteurs, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A welcome break from the 5 a.m. starts for Cubitt today as we went to the Ross Harriers opening meet of the season at Warren Farm Lee in Herefordshire. They left at around 11:30 a.m. with us following. We monitored their movements as they went from field to field trying to pick up a hare to chase. Most harrier packs hunt both hare and fox with little luck. The day seemed pretty disjointed for them, obviously, with limited areas where they were allowed to hunt and a keenness to get away from us whenever we caught up with them. Sabs were with the hunt as they were drawing a kale field, perfectly positioned to see a rather plump fox fleeing past. As supporters were seen alerting the whipper in as to the fox's whereabouts, and a couple of hounds showed an interest in following its line, hunt sabs went straight into action, spraying citronella oil after it and raiding the hounds back, that is, telling them not to follow. We let the huntsman know that the fox had fled, and he made the sensible decision to gather up the hounds and move away from the area. We were following in our vehicle when we drove past the bulk of hunt followers, some of whom threw stones at us. A few bounced off the vehicle, but one smashed the sunroof, showering glass on those inside. Thankfully, no one was hurt, and after a bit of a hold-up clearing away the broken glass, we were back in pursuit of the hunt. We watched them drawing a few more fields around the meet, but before catching up with the huntsman who was on foot and gathering up the hounds before heading back to box up. Throughout the day, a number of hunt followers were seen displaying all the lowest levels of maturity, with a mounted follower swinging his riding crop at Sabs as he went past, and a group of drunken car followers threatening us with violence from the drunk driving, blocking roads, and then squaring up to and threatening members of the public who asked them to move. We have to ask the Ross Harriers whether this kind of behavior that they want to be associated with, They surely by now are well aware that we will expose any violence and vandalism aimed at us, and it is not a deterrent and in fact only makes us more determined and them more of a focus. Until next time. And also in the UK, the Badger Cull has resumed, and once again saboteurs are active in the cull zones in this story from Bite Back, as found in the Earth First Newswire. The UK government's Badger Cull has resumed for another year, and again this year saboteurs have been active in the cull zones, damaging cage traps and saving badgers. And from Cascadia Wildlands, we hear that there is a legal victory for wolves in Washington. Last week, Cascadia Wildlands and the Center for Biological Diversity filed a lawsuit against the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife for its aggressive wolf-killing program. Just days later, kill orders for Sherman and Smackout Wolf Pack members in eastern Washington were rescinded, a huge victory for wolf recovery in the region. The suit challenged the Sherman kill order and the toothless, unenforceable lethal control protocol it was based on. This lawsuit was the culmination of years of frustration with the state's lethal control program at a time when wolves are just beginning to regain a toehold after their systematic eradication. At the end of 2016, a minimum of 115 wolves called Washington home. In addition to yanking the kill permits, the state agreed to give us advance notice, which gives us time to file a restraining order to stop any future efforts to kill recovering wolves should they be deemed illegal. This lawsuit is part of our much larger effort to recover gray wolves across the Pacific West, and our work in Washington will not be possible without your contributions, letters, calls, and emails. Thank you for a Wild Cascadia, signed Nick Cady, Legal Director. And if you need more information, go to cascwild.org. And from Yellowstone, we read that Yellowstone has caused a tragic shift in bison behavior as the Interagency Bison Management Plan kill for the coming winter. In this story from Native News Online, as found on the Earth First Newswire, Yellowstone National Park has just released their 2017 status report on the bison population, and it reveals what we feared. The central herd, who migrates west into the Hebgen Basin and also north into the Gardner Basin, has declined by nearly half. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols in the last few springs had noticed that we were seeing about half the number of buffalo coming to their calving grounds on or around Horse Butte. We looked for them inside the park, but found very few. We contacted Yellowstone's bison biologist, Rick Wallen, who suggested we look in the places that we already had looked. But where had they gone? Well, the harsh reality is that the Interagency Bison Management Plan is causing fundamental and tragic shifts in the buffalo's behavior and migration patterns. Of course, Yellowstone will never admit this. Heck, they don't even want to acknowledge that the central and northern herd have different genetic structures, much less what they are doing to the buffalo's genetics as they arbitrarily slaughter them. The agency's science is nothing but a tool for politics. Whom does Yellowstone serve? Managers know that buffalo from the central herd migrate west into the Hebgen Basin and also north into the Gardner Basin, and thus are doubly exposed and impacted by capture for slaughter operations and hunting. After the winter slaughters of 2005-06 and 2007-08, the central herd was decimated, their numbers stagnated and declined by nearly half in the last year. The central herd is in dire straits. Yellowstone biologists don't have any way to differentiate central from northern buffalo except for a handful of radio-collared females. They have no clue where the other family members who are captured and killed in the Gardner Basin come from. They do not know, nor do they seem to care, what the significantly damaging cumulative impacts of their management schemes are doing to our country's last wild migratory buffalo. They may be loath to admit it or not willing to consider it, but Yellowstone National Park's capture program at Stevens Creek may have altered the population structure, behavior, and social bonds of around 600 buffalo held in captivity and released during the spring of 2011. Social bonds are a uniting force in a herd animal like the buffalo, and extended family ties spanning several generations of buffalo can be seen among matriarchal-led groups. It is altogether possible that when this cohort of buffalo were finally released after months of captivity, the bonds formed between the central and northern herds were so strong that they stayed together on the northern range. Based on Yellowstone's report of radio-collared females, there is some evidence indicating central herd buffalo are now spending their summer in the northern range, a dramatic shift away from the central herd's rutting territory. The outcome for buffalo is tragic. Managers tell us and want us to believe everything is fine, but the fact is Yellowstone National Parks and the state of Montana's unnecessary and intensive management scheme has already altered buffalo's population structure for the worse. As a consequence, we are witnessing the central herd rapidly disappear. With more buffalo in the northern range, more will be killed when they migrate into the Gardner Basin killing zone. With the very structure of the buffalo's population being artificially manipulated and altered, threats outside of management, extended drought, winter range freezing under ice, make the whole population much more vulnerable to extinction. It is utter negligence on the part of Yellowstone National Park and the state of Montana, who are crushing the future of the sacred buffalo, our country's national mammal. A view of the Stevens Creek buffalo trap, where more than 700 buffalo were captured and shipped to slaughter last season, Yellowstone and their IBMP cohorts caved into pressure from Montana's livestock industry and intend to kill between 600 and 1,200 buffalo this coming year. What do the park biologists have to say to managers in the face of evident human mismanagement? Among other things, they recommend that some captured bison may need to be held at the Stevens Creek facility throughout the winter and released in spring to meet these removal composition objectives. Oh-hum, off we go to manage another man-made disaster. And you can get more information at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And we read that Japan has killed 177 whales during its annual hunt in the Pacific Ocean in this story by Samuel Osborne of The Independent. Japan has completed its whaling season in the Northwest Pacific Ocean, having killed 177 whales. Three ships with left port in June caught 43 minke whales and 134 sei whales. Japan's fishing industry agency said it would collect data on the whale's stomach contents and report its findings to the International Whaling Commission. The annual hunt remains highly controversial. While Japan is a signatory to the IWC's moratorium on whale hunting, Tokyo exploits a loophole each year by saying its hunt is conducted for scientific research. Critics say the research is actually a cover for commercial whaling, as the meat from the harpooned mammals is later sold for domestic consumption. Kitty Block, the group's president, said, "My heart sinks each time the Japanese fleet returns to port with these magnificent animals rendered into blocks of meat prepackaged for the supermarkets." Japan continues to wrap its whaling activities in the disguise of science and uses extraordinary sophistry to try and confuse the global public. Make no mistake, this is about killing whales for commercial purposes, something clearly prohibited by international law. She added, the International Whaling Commission has not asked for this research, and its scientific committee has criticized the North Pacific Research Program. Astonishingly, Japan now says it's researching sustainable catch, meaning that the entire point is to kill more of these magnificent protected creatures. Japan's fisheries agency submitted a plan to the IWC to capture 304 whales per year in the northwestern Pacific between 2017 and 2028. The court has ruled that the National Park Service has the right to protect rivers in Alaska in this story from Wilderness Watch. In a victory for our national parks and the preserves in Alaska on October 2nd, the Ninth Circuit Court ruled to uphold the National Park Service's authorities to manage boating activities on navigable rivers within park boundaries in Alaska. Wilderness Watch and other conservation groups filed an amicus brief defending the Park Service's authority to regulate activities on rivers within national parks and preserves in Alaska after a moose hunter sued the Park Service for the right to drive his hovercraft on the Yukon Charley River's National Preserve. The National Park Service prohibits hovercrafts on rivers and national parks and preserves in Alaska, but in 2011, John Sturgeon sued the Park Service, arguing that the surface of the river was non-federal land and that Congress stripped the Park Service of its authority over navigable waters based on a provision of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. The District Court in the Ninth Circuit upheld the Park Service's authority to regulate waters in national parks and preserves in Alaska. After Sturgeon petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the issue, Wilderness Watch joined with several other conservation groups to defend the Park Service's authority to regulate activities on the rivers. The Supreme Court heard the case and issued a narrow decision rejecting the Ninth Court's interpretation of a discrete section of the ANILCA. The Supreme Court stopped there, though it declined to rule on the merits of Sturgeon's arguments, instead opting to send the case back to the Ninth Circuit in 2016 for further analysis. It was an important victory for National Parks, Wilderness, and other conservation units in Alaska, stated Wilderness Watch Executive Director George Nicholas. At Sturgeon One, our wildest rivers and their environs could have been overrun by motorized thrill craft. Alaska's rivers are safer for now. And take action. Protect wilderness in Washington from goat removal. The Park Service is taking comments on a proposal to reduce or eliminate mountain goats via collaring and translocation or aerial or ground-based gunning in Olympic National Park and the Olympic Peninsula in Washington. The proposal calls for around 274 helicopter landings in three wilderness areas in the Cascade Mountains to translocate goats and another undetermined number, presumably at least the same number as for translocation, to pursue, capture, and kill goats in the wildernesses of the Olympic Peninsula, though the impacts of those future activities are not discussed and analyzed. For more information, go to wildernesswatch.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. on our Environment Friday programming. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 a.m., KRFP 90.3 Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon, KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill, Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 also in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California, all rebroadcast the Earth First Update. Check their station schedules for time and date. Or you could go to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number, 4all.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First Updates. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening. And please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.